This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. Thanks for tuning in. This is our week in review, a look at important events from around the world from this past week and putting them in their prophetic context. I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff, Robert Morley.
Good to be here.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello.
Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
And Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
We want to start by talking about the massive hurricane hitting the Pacific coast of Mexico today, Hurricane Patricia. Is expected to make landfall shortly. Earlier today, it became the most powerful tropical cyclone ever measured in the Western Hemisphere, with maximum sustained winds hitting an unprecedented 200 miles per hour, with gusts even more powerful than that. It looks like it's going to be more powerful than Hurricane Andrew was in 1992, more powerful than Katrina in 2005. The National Hurricane Center in Miami is warning of a potentially catastrophic landfall and says it's expected to remain an extremely dangerous Category 5 hurricane as it hits ground this evening. This hurricane could cause massive death and destruction to a huge area in southwestern Mexico on the Pacific coast. It's expected to dump 8 to 12 inches of rain, up to 20 inches in some places. That could produce threatening flash floods and mudslides. This is CNN. It says Patricia's intensity is comparable to Typhoon Haiyan, which hit the Philippines in 2013, the World Meteorological Organization tweeted. More than 6,000 people died in that typhoon due largely to enormous storm surges that rushed through coastal areas. Haiyan had 195-mile-an-hour sustained winds when it made landfall. CNN meteorologist Chad Myers said this is the only hurricane that has ever been this powerful. So we're definitely thinking of the people in the path of this hurricane. We're going to keep our eyes on this story as it develops. But it's amazing how often these once-in-a-generation type events are happening, or once-in-a-century, or even once-in-a-millennium. That was the way that the flooding in South Carolina was described just earlier this month. But usually, you know, we're living in climate-controlled environments, and our modern world keeps us sheltered from the effects of the weather far more than it ever has in the past. But then these massive events occur that remind us of how powerful the natural world is, the power, sometimes catastrophic power, that can make us feel so small, and it reminds us of just how helpless we can be in the face of these kinds of forces. We've developed some pretty amazing technology to predict these events, although this particular storm came up extremely quickly. Basically, it wasn't expected at all just a couple of days ago. Not much advance notice in this case, but even when we can predict them, there's basically nothing we can do to stop them. You see people putting up sandbags or boarding up windows, but this hurricane is going to hit, and it's going to hit hard, and there's nothing that we can do about it. And it's important for us to remember this. It's important for all of us to just think about this. Why do events like this happen? We live in a materialistic world, and people seek materialistic explanations. In this case, there are people saying that El Nino raised the water temperature a few days, and basically they think that may have tipped this specific event over the edge into something far more devastating than it would have been otherwise. But really, they don't know what causes these things, or they certainly cannot predict them to any great degree. The weather is so complicated. There's so many factors at play. And there's a reason why the weathermen are wrong in their forecasts so often. But at the Trumpet, we look at things not so much through a materialistic lens, but through the lens of biblical prophecy. And there's a lot in the Bible about weather, and a lot about climatic disasters and natural disasters, weather disasters. There's a lot about these things taking place, these kinds of events. There's a lot of in the Bible explaining why these things happen and even talking about our part in these types of events. If you accept the biblical explanation, you have to acknowledge that there are man-made causes for these events. There's a lot in the Bible about how God is in control of these forces, and he doesn't necessarily cause catastrophes like hurricanes, although there are biblical examples where he has caused these events. There are also other biblical examples where he didn't cause them, and you can't necessarily know offhand in any given case. But even where God doesn't cause it, he does allow it, and that's something that causes a lot of people problems. Why would God allow something like this? What kind of God would let these things happen? These are really important questions, and the fact is people don't ask them enough. Most people put them out of their minds. If they do consider them, they quickly move on from them. But it is important for us to ask, why would God allow events like this hurricane? We need to pay attention when these events happen. When you have people whose lives are being destroyed by the hundreds, by the thousands, when you see billions of dollars worth of destruction, it should cause us to sit up and take notice and to come out of our bubble of self-concern, to challenge our assumptions about the world, our assumptions about God. These aren't easy questions to answer. But it is important to try. We have a booklet that addresses these questions. It's called Why Natural Disasters. It directly addresses the issues that this raises. It talks about what's wrong with the weather and just how many of these events are happening now. Why does God allow these types of events? Why does God allow suffering? And it even puts these recent disasters in context. Are they signs of the end of the world? That's another question that is on a lot of people's mind. But you can find this booklet online at thetrumpet.com under the literature tab. It's a substantial booklet. It's one that brings a lot of clarity to this important subject. And meanwhile, we'll keep our eyes on this storm moving through Mexico. We will turn our attention now to events in Europe, and for that we'll turn to Richard, and he's via Skype from our office in the UK. Richard, can you give us the overview of important European headlines this week?
Well, the EU is considering getting more involved in Libya. If the different factions over there manage to form a unity government, then the EU will immediately start talks to have a military or civilian mission over there. And that's according to EU documents seen by Reuters. They may also try to protect Libya's oil resources through a mission there, or government facilities further down the line. So there's a potential for a dramatic increase in Europe's involvement in North Africa, and really a very naked protection of their own interests over there. Then there's also an interesting article in the Trumpet Weekly that I'll draw attention to, speculating that German Chancellor Angela Merkel may be planning to go down in flames over the refugee crisis, that this would be her exit strategy for the chancellorship, that she's decided that going down, standing up for immigrants will mean that history will look favorably on her. I think that's an interesting theory. I don't know whether I agree with it or not, but it's interesting to note that you've got more and more people are talking about that this crisis has a potential to be the end of Merkel's chancellorship.
All right, thank you, Richard. And the top story from Europe this week.
Top story today, we're not going to be talking about the refugee crisis. We're not talking about the euro crisis. Seems a long time we've not had a top story that's not one of those two, though we'll come back to the euro crisis later. Instead, I'd like to talk today about President Xi Jinping's visit to London. It's we have an article in the Trumpet Weekly called The Great British Kowtow, and that pretty much sums it up. Britain has been kowtowing to China in fairly humiliating way, really. They've been rolling out the reddest of red carpets, as it's been put. Here's some. Actually, George Osborne went to China last month, I think it is. And here are some quotes from when he was over there. He said, "Let's stick together to make Britain China's best partner in the West. And he said, no economy in the world is as open to Chinese investment as the UK. And then this article from Fraser Nelson in The Spectator that we have in the Trumpet Weekly says, all told, the Chancellor looked as if he was attempting the world record for the longest kowtow in diplomatic history. The Chinese will seldom have seen anything like it. And Britain is really doing all that they can to court China. But the other interesting aspect, or one of the most interesting aspects to me in this, is that they're ditching America in order to do it. So Rob Morley talked about this on the program a few months ago, where you had the Asia Investment and Infrastructure, the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank that China was setting up. And the U.S. was very firm, you know, none of our allies should get involved in this. We're not getting involved in this. And really, it was Britain that led the way in ignoring America and saying, well, actually, nope, we're going to go after China. And you see every week almost tensions between the U.S. and China arising. The U.S. may not really be acting on those, but China is – there's certainly more and more rhetoric, and China is doing more and more to committing more acts of aggression against America's allies in the Pacific. And meanwhile, Britain is just bowing and scraping before China. So it's quite the contrast.
Yeah, it's very interesting with China rising in as many arenas as it is, and the America having really burned its bridges with the UK over the last few years under the Obama administration. What's to stop Britain from moving in that direction or away from the United States?
Yeah, that's true. And if you look at, how America treats its allies and treats its enemies, there's not really much – you don't seem to get any better treatment from America by being an ally. And so
– no, you could almost say it's worse.
Yeah. So the government may well have decided, well, if we move towards China, America's not going to punish us. But we've got a lot to gain from China. So they're really doing a lot of – the one that really stood out for me was – to me was letting China build a nuclear power station in Britain. So you've got America worried about Chinese – hackers hacking into America's infrastructure, hacking into its essential electric grid and things like that. And then you've got Britain saying, come build a nuclear power station on our soil. I mean, they wouldn't even need to hack that one. They built it.
Well, that's it is remarkable. Robert, can you just give us a sense of what it is that it would cause Britain to be so beholden to China, say, economically speaking, what sort of position they're in? Because we've talked before about just how compromised the United States is because of its debt that is Chinese-owned.
Yeah, absolutely. This week, Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, I think, had an article, and he talked about Osborne and Britain really embracing China and trying to make China their next go-to nation economically, trying to get the Chinese open up and let British business get involved in China. And I mean, that is because China is the growing economy in the world, even though lately they've had a bit of a crash. Their stock markets have corrected. I think they're down around 40% or something like that. But when you look around the world, that's where the growth has been taking place. And Britain sees that. And I think they're trying to hitch their boat to China. And more recently, as China has had some of these economic troubles, analysts like Pritchard Evans said, well, maybe Britain's making a mistake. You know, China has, look what's going on over there. They've overbuilt, they're unstable, things like that. But to me, the bigger question is, maybe China should be wondering about hitching its boat to the UK. If you take a look at the United Kingdom, what do they produce these days? What do they have really to offer China except to exploit the last vestiges of wealth that remain in that nation? They have a banking sector, and if they open that up to China, I mean, China has some massive state-owned banks. That's big competition if that goes that way. So maybe China's looking at Britain as a way to get into Europe and to pick the last plums that are available. I think that's something Britain should be asking themselves right now.
Do you have any thoughts about that, Richard?
Well, it's not like Britain's getting much in return so far. I guess there are some economic benefits. There was something in the news today about Britain being pretty much the top trading hub for the renminbi outside of China. But in terms of diplomatic protocol, this article points out that, I think it was this one that we've got in the Trumpet Weekly, that when representatives from Britain's foreign ministry sent over to China, they're giving an absolutely appalling reception. But Britain is so desperate for funds and trade from China that they're not, they don't protest, they don't summon the Chinese ambassador, they don't dare do anything to upset China. I think it's a, I mean, it's a quite dramatic symptom of where how the globe has shifted and where global power is shifting. But I think a lot of Britain's efforts, they're more in hope than in anything we've actually gotten from China so far.
It'll be interesting to see where this goes. Britain is, it's standing in the world. It just continues to fall. It conducts itself as a second or third rate power. So dramatically different from its historical standing in the world, but it will be interesting to see how this relationship develops and if anything comes of that that nuclear power that you're talking about that it's going to establish on British shores. You're listening to our Week in Review program. We're looking at the big stories from around the world this past week. We'll transition now to the Middle East and to Brent Noctegal. Let's look at the overview to begin.
Yeah, the United States confirmed this week that Iran has fired a medium-range missile that was capable of delivering a nuclear weapon. Now, this is breaking a UN Security Council ban for such missiles, but we don't expect the Security Council to do too much about it, considering Russia and China's veto on that. But this, of course, just comes a couple of months after the nuclear deal, and now they've got a weapon system that can deliver a nuclear bomb. Egypt has started voting for its next parliament. As opposed to two elections ago, the Muslim Brotherhood are not a part of it. So the president there that's in power, Sisi, he is expected to stay in power. But we are expecting a change, at least of alliances at some point in Egypt. So that is something to watch, just in case there are some up-and-comers that want to completely ditch their relationship with America. One final thing was there was a pretty successful mission inside Iraq this week led by U.S. Marines. And with Iraqi forces, they rescued about 70 hostages that were taken captive and had an imminent threat of execution by the Islamic State. And one U.S. soldier was actually killed in that successful rescue attempt. And that's the first death of an American since their war against the Islamic State started last year.
All right, and your top story for the Middle East.
This is what Charles Krauthammer says in his column today, and I'll just read his introduction. Guess who just popped up in the Kremlin? Bashar Assad, Syrian dictator and destroyer, now Vladimir Putin's newest pet. After 4 years holed up in Damascus, Assad was summoned to Russia to bend a knee to Putin, show the world that today Middle East questions get settled not in Washington, but in Moscow, and officially bless the Russian-led four-nation takeover of Syria now underway. So this was the big news. This meeting took place on Tuesday when Assad arrived in Syria, in Moscow. We didn't hear about this till Wednesday when Assad was safely back in Damascus. It looks like the Russian Air Force actually lifted him out of there on one of their planes and then brought him back in the course of a day. There weren't too many. There was a photo op, obviously, of this. This is what Putin wanted the world to see, that Assad's first trip in 4 years out of his country is to Moscow, nowhere else, not even to Iran, interestingly. And this is what the public remarks of Putin were after. He said that Putin praised Assad for fighting against international terrorism, which he had done, quote, effectively on its own for a number of years. So anyone with a brain looking at that comment can look at the Syrian crisis, and Putin saying that Assad has done this effectively for a number of years. Tell that to the families of the 250,000 people that are dead. Tell that to Europe, who has a million refugees winding up on its doorstep. I don't think that the world would agree with him that Assad has done an effective job fighting terrorism. Of course, in Putin's eyes, everyone that fights against Assad in Syria is a terrorist. So we're not exactly sure what they discussed in private. There was a Kuwaiti daily that came out reporting on some of the event, some of the discussion that might have took place. And they said that part of one of the big things that came out of it was Putin telling Assad that if the rebels actually received any of these man-portable air defense systems that are capable of shooting down Russian jets, that Russia is willing to strike any other nation in the Middle East that sold the rebels that military hardware. Now, this is big. Two weeks ago, remember, we talked about Russia firing cruise missiles from the Caspian Sea to hit rebels, again, enemies of Assad inside Syria. And obviously, that was more than just to attack the rebels. That was a sign to all the Middle Eastern nations that are against Assad that we can also target you if we want to. Our cruise missiles from the Caspian, they can reach your cities as well. So now it looks like they have the threat of force if these anti-aircraft weapons do get deployed. Now, that would be a game changer in Syria if you had Saudi supplied or Qatari supplied anti-aircraft portable devices that could shoot down Russian jets. So Putin is worried about that, and he's just given advance notice that we're not going to accept it.
We just finished our November-December trumpet issue this week, and Brent, you've got an article in there about how Russia outmaneuvered the U.S. in Syria. It's just interesting to look at this in light of the events that you cover in that article. That'll be going up on the website, I'm sure, next week. But in light of the red line, in light of basically the United States issuing this warning and then saying, if you can figure out some way to take care of your chemical weapons, and then Russia stepping in and saying we will take care of it, and really undermining the United States and usurping American the power position in that country, you view this in light of that. It's just a really fascinating development. We have in the Trumpet Weekly this article from the Daily Beast, according to one U.S. diplomat. The theories for why Putin extended the invitation to Assad are A, stick it to the West, B, show the West that Russia is the place to come for consultations with Assad. If you want to get rid of this guy, you'll need to come through us. Or C, consultations before the Lavrov-Kerry Saudi-Turkish trilats later this week. At any rate, it's really positioned itself as the go-to power, the most dominant force in that entire theater.
Right. It is a huge game changer. If you're going to, obviously the United States and a lot of Western allies in Europe as well have wanted Assad removed for 4 years, perhaps longer than that, but they've been calling for that to happen for about 4 years. And then you have Putin, who, you know, we've seen what he's done in Ukraine. We know the nuclear arsenal that he has. You have to pretty much, well, you're going to have to tiptoe around him if you're going to get your way, or, well, maybe that's a bad way to put it. You're going to have to go through him. He's going to have to agree for Assad's departure from now on. I mean, it might have been possible earlier if he didn't step in, but now that he's there, you're going to have a confrontation. So we don't expect that to happen. We don't expect the United States to come on strong now after 4 years of giving up ground, and then finally to come on strong with Putin and say, no, Assad's going and we're going to do something about it. That's not what it looks like. Essentially, what we can see inside Syria is that Putin is presenting two choices to the world by taking out not the Islamic State, but taking out all the other guys that could potentially lead Syria. He's destroying them so that the world has two choices. Do you want the Islamic State to rule Syria, or do you want Assad to rule Syria? Now, the natural choice for all of us would be to choose Assad to rule Syria instead of the Islamic State. But that is a decision that's been beautifully crafted, if I can put it that way, by the Russians over the last 4 years to keep their guy in power.
Well, they've also just done an amazing job of selling what they're doing, messaging this, and even his statements to Assad, where he's just blatantly spinning this as he is the defender of justice. He's waging this campaign against terrorism in the region. In some ways, it shouldn't be, but it's almost shocking just how how opposite to what's actually happening there it really is. But he's a very bold man.
And he's a professional at this. He knows how fickle public opinion is. He knows in a year's time when you've got the Islamic State still a power in Syria and that other option of Assad is still there, that the world will eventually forget the past and Assad with him.
I think the title of your article says it all. Russia outmaneuvered the U.S. in Syria. We're watching it happen week by week, and it just keeps getting worse. Well, thank you, Brent. You're listening to our Week in Review program. The articles that we're talking about are in this week's Trumpet Weekly. This is a very informative report that we produce each week at thetrumpet.com. We really try to pack the most significant stories from around the world into this publication. I encourage you to subscribe. It's free. You just go online to thetrumpet.com to subscribe to The Trumpet Weekly. Coming up, we'll look at the important news from Asia and America. Later on in the program, our lightning round of headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
You're listening to our Week in Review program. We're talking about the big stories from around the world from this past week. We're going to turn now to Asia and to Jeremiah Jacques. We'll start with the overview of events from Asia.
Well, Russian President Vladimir Putin's popularity has gone through the roof. A new poll this week said that his approval rating among Russians is now the highest it's ever been. It's just below 90%. It's hovering at 89.9%. And analysts say that the surge is because of his decision to fly those airstrikes in Syria that we heard Brent talking about. Then you go to North Korea, and the very opposite is happening. The loyalty of the elites to Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un is reportedly eroding away. This report says that if loyalty was at 100 points under the reign of the nation's founder, Kim Il-sung, then it would right now be just around 10 percentage points. There have already been some really high-profile defections from the North Korean government, and if this trend persists, there could be more. And then also, a new Chinese anti-ship ballistic missile is really bad news for U.S. aircraft carriers. That is the assessment of a report in the Business Insider, and it says that China has developed what might be called a carrier killer missile, which could really shift the whole balance of power there in East Asia.
All right, and your top story from Asia this week?
It is that Russia is very close to completing a permanent military base in the Arctic. This is a really sizable base. It's 150,000 square feet. It's equipped with the most modern gear. And once it's completed, it'll be able to house 150 soldiers totally autonomously for up to 18 months. So this is it's also really significant that it's only about 300 miles from American territory there in Alaska. And this base is part of a larger trend that we're seeing by Russia this year, especially of just asserting itself as an Arctic nation, really as the Arctic nation. Moscow filed a United Nations claim earlier this year for a huge swath of the region that includes the North Pole. It said, we want to be officially recognized as the, you know, the controllers of this whole area. And it has built or reopened several other installations throughout the region. It's a really resource-rich region, so Russia wants to make sure that it has a way to tap into those resources.
Just out of curiosity, the military installation that it's put there, is that in keeping with its already recognized territorial claims, or is this basically de facto, we're there whether the UN likes it or not?
Well, from what I could tell, this is part of a region that was already claimed by Russia, but it was not acknowledged by the UN. But who's going to challenge it at this point?
Right.
And then there have also been several war games that Russia has held there in the Arctic region. So it just shows, despite, you know, the UN's reluctance to sign off on Russian control of the region, Russia is controlling it. And I think this story is especially important when it's placed in the context of a forecast that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury made back in 2008. This was just after Russia had invaded the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, there on the southern border of Russia. And Mr. Fleury said that that event marked the beginning of a dangerous new era in history. I'll just read a short quote from what Mr. Fleury wrote. He said, "Russia's attack on Georgia in August marks the beginning of a dangerous new era in history. Russia is determined to be an energy superpower in an age when the whole modern world is hungry for energy. If Russia sees its primary source of oil being threatened, it is going to fight. This was the first military strike of a rising Asian superpower, and there will be more." So that was in late 2008 when Mr. Fleury said there will be more Russian moves toward resurgence, toward expanding power. And if you look back at all that has happened since then, it's just really clear that that forecast was spot on. Russia invaded and annexed the Crimean Peninsula, and it locked a lot of eastern Ukraine into sort of a frozen conflict. Russia has placed parts of Moldova under kind of a de facto Russian control. The same has happened in Kyrgyzstan and Georgia and elsewhere. Russia is, of course, flexing its military muscles in Syria in a huge way, as Brent talked about there. And now Russia is orchestrating this massive military buildup in the Arctic. So if you look at all this together, kind of look at it from a higher altitude, the picture that you see is of a very expansionistic, assertive, and even aggressive Russia. Its rise is sending geopolitical ripples through every part of the world. It's a catalyst for new alliances. It's a force that's breaking old alliances. It's literally redrawing the map in some places, and it's just changing the world. It's making it less stable. And just as Mr. Fleury said, it is ushering in a dangerous new era.
I'm really glad you read us that quote from 2008. So that is really interesting. If you're looking at Georgia kind of as the starting point, and the other thing that he mentioned there specifically was energy resources. And could you just tell us a little bit more about, say, this region of the Arctic? You said it's resource rich. I think in the Trumpet Weekly, there's this statement about just the oil reserves or the energy reserves in that part of the Arctic.
Yes, it is believed to be to be home to huge reservoirs of oil and natural gas. I think a lot of it is speculative at this point, but they say that with new technologies and with some shifts in the climate, all of those reserves are going to be accessible in a way that they haven't been before. And so this is a great time for someone who wants to be in control of resources like that to be really trying to make inroads into the Arctic region.
It is almost laughable to think about the UN doing anything to stop this, or what power is there when you basically don't have any nations that are willing to do anything to stop them in Ukraine, to stop them in Syria. Well, who's going to fight over the Arctic?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Russia knows that at this point, it's a great time to be expanding, to be pushing, because Europe is not yet united enough to really be able to challenge it. The U.S. is in full retreat on the global stage, so why not?
We, in this new edition of the Trumpet, the November-December issue that we just finished, we have a two-page infographic. Richard Palmer put the data together about just the shifting global military spending and just how much it's increasing in recent years. It's interesting to look. There's one part of this graph that shows the contrast between military spending in 2000 and military spending in 2014, the last year we have complete figures. The United States military spending is gargantuan. It's just so massive compared to the rest of the world. And yet, you look at Russian military spending, it's definitely gone up between 2000 and 2014, but it's still, by comparison, it's quite small. We talk a little bit about just the Russia-China alliance and the two of them put together. It's interesting, when you look at 2000, those two nations combined had a defense spending that was about 17% of America's spending, whereas now, in 2014... their combined spending has increased to about 50% of America's spending, or it's like 48.9, something like that. But to look at the outsized influence that Russia has with the comparatively small amount of military spending, that figure in and of itself does not account for the will when you have a leader who is willing to step out and make these moves and just seems to be outplaying just about everyone else on the chessboard, it's pretty remarkable what he's able to accomplish with the resources that he has.
Yes, that's right. If you factor in will to use power, then there's no comparison. It doesn't matter how much you spend. If you're not willing to really wield that power in any significant way, then all the spending is negligible.
Then you can also just consider the bang for the buck. If you look at the bang for the buck that the Russians and the Chinese get for their dollars, and you look how much we're spending on things like pensions over here and, you know, veterans benefits.
Right.
I mean,
it's not actually weaponry. It's not actually going into something that it's just military personnel.
Yeah, absolutely. And the media portrays it like we have this massive budget. We're outspending the rest of the world. Well, yeah, the Russians and the Chinese aren't giving their soldiers pensions like we are over here and things like that. So I think there is a definite disconnect there. We're not comparing apples to apples.
Well, you're listening to our Week in Review program. We're going to go now to Anglo-America. We'll turn to Robert for the overview.
Sure. On Monday, Canadians went to the polls to elect their next prime minister. And it was the highest turnout in more than 20 years. And the result was pretty emphatic. It was a stunning victory for Liberal leader Justin Trudeau, who promised Canada and Canadians, quote, sunny ways and change. And in Canada, this is a huge swing to the left. The Conservatives had been in power for the last 10 years. And I think it's really interesting just to look at how closely aligned the new prime minister is with President Obama, from everything from his background and how he was raised to his social, foreign, and economic policies. And although this is big news for Canada, it's also big news for Americans too, because Canada's America's biggest trade partner in the world. So what happens in Canada has the potential to affect America as well. So that was the first item. The other item is that I wanted to talk about is that My Budget 360 is reporting that Americans' income is stagnating and that we're seeing increasing evidence that people are turning to debt to finance their standards of living. This, of course, is something we've talked a lot about in the past at thetrumpet.com. And we know that turning to debt is something that is, you know, to finance your standard of living is totally unsustainable in the long run. It's something that can't continue forever. Yet these numbers that My Budget 360 brings out are pretty dramatic. They're calling these two areas of debt the twin towers of debt. And we know the analogy of what happened with the twin towers. It's all going to come crashing down at some point. And they talk about student debt and auto loan debt. And they say the point that caught my eye so dramatically was that student debt, it was only $240 billion not that long ago. Back in 2004, I think, and today we're over $1.3 trillion worth of student debt. And this is money that as graduates are finding out they can't pay back. They're graduating from college with degrees that are useless. They're working in fast food and other areas. And this is debt that they can't get rid of because student loan debt, by law, is undischargeable through bankruptcy law. This is debt they were stuck with their entire life that they need to pay back, and there's no way out. And we're going to see this as a bigger topic going forward, I think, as we approach these elections. And we know the Democrat candidate Sanders and Clinton have made writing off student debt and canceling student debt and providing free college to all Americans as centerpieces of their campaign.
And your top story.
Well, the big story this week, I'd like to talk about another article that was published by Charles Hugh Smith. He's a popular financial blogger. He's previously a money manager and author. And he has this article titled, Four Ticking Global Time Bombs Few Ever Hear. And just as a way to introduce this topic, I want to read you a quote from his article. He begins by saying, the geopolitical and financial risks facing the global economy are well known. Hot wars, currency meltdowns garner headlines around the world, but few ever hear, much less discuss, these four ticking global time bombs. And then he goes through this article and he discusses them. So he hits four of these, and we'll talk about a couple of them. The first one he talks about is this demographic time bomb. And I think this is something that is really sneaking up on Americans and shouldn't be. He talks about how we are soon, Americans are soon going to find out that all these promises politicians have made to future retirees, they aren't going to get paid. And if you look at demographics in America, 10,000 people per day are retiring. And this is a huge trend, he says, and people who are planning on getting their payments aren't going to get their payments. Then he goes through and he hits what he calls a public health time bomb. He talks about the oil export time bomb, and he talks about the agricultural soil food water time bomb.
All right. Well, thank you, Robert. Pretty interesting things to set our minds on. All of these things you're talking about, different areas where we could potentially see catastrophic results from the way that we're doing things right now, that we can't flee from the results of the way that we're doing things.
Yeah, that's what he's hit the point he's trying to make. These things are baked into the cake, and they're coming.
The oil export time bomb, can you just give us a brief overview of that one?
Sure, absolutely. So fracking has brought on, has bought America a lot of time. Oil production has come up, but what we're seeing now is it's leveled off, it's coming down. But the bigger danger that he points to is the fact that oil exporting nations, remember, America doesn't export oil. We use up every bit of oil we produce here and import a lot more, even with all the fracking. But he's saying these oil exporting nations, their populations are starting to consume ever increasing amounts of oil. And that is tightening up the supply. And he says a lot of these fields from exporters in Russia and Saudi Arabia are old and they're getting tight. And he said the longer oil prices stay low, the greater the chances that we face another oil shock in the future.
You're listening to our Week in Review. You can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly. That's our weekly news report, and the stories that we're talking about on the program today are in this report. We're going to finish up the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, starting with Brent.
We talked earlier about how Russia is in Syria. Well, last week, the call went out from certain Iraqis for Russia to come help fight the Islamic State inside Iraq. Now, of course, the United States is the one leading the coalition against the Islamic State inside Iraq. And then, so the Joint Chief of Staff, he came out and said this week that if Russia is in there fighting the Islamic State, the Americans cannot be there as well. So this is the Iraqi government kind of faces an ultimatum here, that what would they rather, the American support or the Russian support? Now, this is something that probably shouldn't have been said at all by the Americans, because the main pushes for Russian intervention inside Iraq are what we know as the Shiite militias, and they are headed by Iran. Right now, the president or the prime minister of Iraq, he wants the Americans in, but he is suffering from a lot of blowback from these militias who actually have more troops on the ground than his own army. And he needs these militias, these boots on the ground, to fight back the Islamic State. So if you've got the Iraqi prime minister that needs Iran's influence inside Iraq to fight the Islamic State, then what you're going to have them decide is, what the Iranians are going to decide is, when the Americans say, hey, we're out if Russia comes in, the Iranians are probably going to be encouraging the Russians to come in. For the past 35 years, Iran has wanted America out of the Middle East, and the U.S. has given them the out by encouraging the Russians, by saying that they're out if the Russians come in. Instead of saying, hey, Russia, no, don't, or we'll have some words to you about that, or maybe some actions, instead they're saying, okay, if you want the Russians, we're out of here, thinking that is going to stop the Iraqi government calling for Russian help when the Iraqi government isn't actually controlling Iraq, Iran is.
The story just keeps getting worse, doesn't it? It's amazing. All right, moving on now to Richard.
The euro crisis may be on its way back, this time in Portugal. They had an election earlier this month, and after that election, the left-wing parties in Portugal have put aside their quite considerable differences and long-standing historical grievances, and they've done that to oppose the austerity being forced upon Portugal by the European authorities. And so these left-wing parties have a majority in parliament. They're ready to form a coalition, but the communist and the left parties, in that potential coalition. They're pretty extreme left. The Portuguese president doesn't like that. So instead, he's asked the centre-right party to form a government. Now, it looks like the centre, looks like these left-wing parties will be able to get rid of that centre-right party in about a week or two. So it seems like a pretty futile move on the part of the president. And so if that plays out, we'll have the left-wing coalition with those pretty extreme left-wing parties as part of it in power in Portugal very soon. And we'll have a very close repeat of what we happened in Greece. They're going to try and get rid of the austerity. They're going to reject a lot of the measures that have been forced upon them by Europe. The left wing, the left party and the communist party are ready to quit the euro. The more mainstream left party, the socialists, they're not so keen on that idea. So we could get a very similar repeat to Greece. And we have an article on this in the Trumpet Weekly by Ambrose Evans-Pritchard. It's the top article in our Europe section. And he covers all of this. But what I like about his article is it also brings out just how big Europe's economic problems are and about how these type of crises are just going to keep on coming. So even if Portugal follows Greece all the way and gets kind of beaten down, it's only a matter of time before the next party or the next country rebels against Europe's authority and the austerity mandate, and the crisis just keeps moving until Europe is forced to unite and some countries are forced out.
Right. Thank you very much, Richard. And we'll move on to Jeremiah.
Well, China announced this week that it is planning to abandon its wildly unpopular one-child policy. This policy was adopted 35 years ago as a government policy used to control the population. It is said every couple is allowed to have one child and only one child. And it actually led to a fertility rate throughout China of 1.5. So that's well below the 2.1 rate that's required just to replace a population. And so it led to a lot of problems demographically for China, a massive labor shortage in some areas, and just a rapidly aging population. And the Communist Party now says that for the next five-year plan, which will go from 2016 to 2020, there will be a new two-child policy. This one-child policy was just terribly brutal. It was to blame for about 400 million abortions in China. 37 million of those were believed to have been sex selective. If couples were allowed to have only one child, then they would abort girls so that they could have a boy that could carry on the family name. So this is it's pretty big news. And in the long term, 15 to 20 years or so, it would mean a more populous, more powerful China, even with military implications. But even in the near term, it immediately means a big morale boost for the Chinese. The one-child policy was really brutal. It was a terrible human rights abuse. It was wildly unpopular. So by abandoning it, Chinese President Xi Jinping will really enjoy a big boost in his popularity.
All right. Thank you, Jeremiah. We'll move on now to Robert.
Well, there seems to be a refugee pushback starting to grow, at least in several states here in the U.S. We're starting to see some protests springing up from concerned citizens who are upset with the federal government's immigration policy, in particular the fact that the federal government is accepting so many refugees. And it's really starting to divide America on this. For example, in St. Cloud, Minnesota, there's a group of concerned citizens who were visibly upset and very angry at a town hall meeting on Tuesday when Governor Mark Dayton announced that, in his words, you know, anybody who is not comfortable with the state's growing diversity, including its expanding Somali refugee population, should, quote, find another state, unquote, because Minnesota's economy cannot expand based on, quote, white B-plus native-born citizens, end quote. And then Dayton went on to basically just disregard anybody's concerns, just say, you know, they're illegitimate concerns. He said, quote, if you're that intolerant, if you're that much of a racist or a bigot, then find another state, he told those people who were protesting. And then he went on to say, find a state where the minority population is 1% or whatever. This is not in Minnesota. It's not going to be again. So we see this backlash starting to grow because under President Obama, immigration has increased so much. He says he wants to take another 10,000 Syrians this year and another 10,000 next year. And all told, he wants to bring in another 200,000 refugees over the next 2 years from all nations, and he's settling them in a lot of communities who are just uncomfortable having their cultures radically changed practically overnight by massive influxes from people around the world. So this is a trend that we need to keep watching.
All right. Thank you, Robert. I want to just conclude with a little story here. You may have heard about Ahmed Mohammed. He's a 14-year-old student in Texas who was arrested for bringing a device to school that could be mistaken for a bomb. It was supposedly a clock that he invented, and there was a big kerfuffle over the fact that it looked like a suitcase bomb, and the police came and took a look at it. I think they took him to the police station. At any rate, the big story that came as a result of it was that the school was Islamophobic, that they racially profiled this boy, the boy's father. He said his son was mistreated because his name is Muhammad and because of September 11th. And this boy himself, he said, if I was a Caucasian male, I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have gotten arrested. He became quite a celebrity for having these supposed scientific achievements and the fact that he was a victim of this horrible racial profiling. President Obama tweeted to him, "Cool clock, Ahmed. You want to bring it to the White House?" There were a lot of other media outlets that played up this story pretty big, and he was invited to the United Nations. He received offers of opportunity from Google, from Twitter, from Facebook because of his supposed genius qualities. He appeared on talk shows. A GoFundMe campaign sought to raise money so that he could attend MIT. Microsoft sent him several thousand dollars worth of products. He was quite a celebrity. But the truth has come out that's the version of events that we're told in most media outlets isn't necessarily true. What's interesting is he recently met with Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir, who is obviously not the most savory of characters. He's accused of orchestrating genocide and crimes against humanity in Darfur. But he has a history of pranks at the school. The details of this clock itself, there's an article in the Daily Beast that said anybody with even a basic hobby level understanding can see it was a commercially available mass produced product that was just taken out of its enclosure and placed in a pencil box. He didn't invent anything. He just concocted this thing that was really made to look like a suitcase bomb by all appearances. But these details that have come out, the media isn't interested in these things. They've already told their story. They're not going back and reporting on what's happened since this event that just took place at the White House. This boy was... The fact that he had visited Sudan's president made things a little bit awkward for the White House. So what they had hoped would be a real big event with the president meeting him, they just kind of played it down a little bit more quietly. He was allowed to attend this event, but he didn't meet with the president personally. It's interesting, though. There's a Selwyn Duke wrote an article about this, and he quotes Jonathan Swift from 1710 that says, "Falsehood flies, and the truth comes limping after it, so that when men come to be undeceived, it is too late. The jest is over, and the tale has had its effect." And that is certainly the case with the way that the media handled this story, the White House, everyone else. If it doesn't fit the narrative, they're not interested in it. The tale has had its effect, and we're all left in the wake. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we've talked about are in this week's edition. We'd love to hear from you. Email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Follow us on Twitter @thetrumpet_com. Find us on Facebook or Google Plus by searching for Philadelphia Trumpet. Thanks to our panel, Brent Noctegal, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, and Robert Morley.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of Leonardo da Vinci. Simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.